Every month when I plan worship, I go to plan worship for the month. I look at this calendar that has all of the holidays and celebrations, special holy days, secular holidays, for the whole month. And February is a really interesting month. Back dab in the middle is Valentine's Day, of course. But we all know that this is Black History Month. And I started to think, what an interesting juxtaposition that is. What does love have to do with Black history? While Hallmark tends to focus on more private forms of love, romantic love, the love of family, the emotional bonds of friendship, there's another form of love. It's called agape in Greek, the love of humanity. The kind of love that connects us all. And it's this kind of love that we tend to associate with Black history, especially the civil rights movement, where the power of love triumphed over hate. We tend to be really proud of that history as a time of victory, a time when so many people came together to stand against the forces of oppression, hatred. Martin Luther King talked a lot about the importance of this kind of love. He said, the greatest force in the universe, love is the greatest force in the universe, the heartbeat of the moral cosmos. He said, he who loves is a participant in the being of God. Love was the apex of the civil rights movement in so many ways. And it's not hard for me to translate the concept of God into all that is, the interconnected web of all existence, if you will. For me, God is synonymous with the inescapable network of mutuality, that single garment of destiny that Dr. King talks about. To love is to live into our connections, knowing that the welfare of any one of us is bound up in the welfare of all of us. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Love was at the heart of the Southern Freedom Movement, the kind of love that binds each to all. A powerful soul force, Martin Luther King called it, that walked hand in hand with justice. Dr. King said, power is at its best love implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love. It was this kind of power that inspired countless Black women, men, and children to put their lives on the line. For justice. Of course, there were white allies there too. Some were injured, and a few, including Unitarian minister James Reeb, lost their lives at the hands of white vigilantes. But the stakes have always been so much higher. Let's not forget that. So much higher for African Americans. We just don't know their names. We don't know the multitude of names of people who have been injured bodily, injured emotionally over the course of 400 years. But as I get older, the older I get, the more I wonder what love really has to do with dismantling these systems, these insidious systems of oppression. And the more I learn about Black history, the more overwhelming it gets, actually. But the more those systems seem so insidious, they're like shapeshifters that simply take different forms when they're exposed to the light, morphing from one form, one system to another. Slavery morphed into a post-Reconstruction era known as redemption I'd actually never heard that term before until I read this really great book, which I'm going to actually hold up. It's called Stony the Road. The subtitle is White Supremacy and the Rise of Jim Crow, written by Henry Louis Gates, in which he explains that the gains of African Americans immediately after the Civil War really only lasted less than a decade before the South vowed that it would rise again. During this period that goes all the way through the 60s, 1960s, 100 years later, what we know as Jim Crow, the former Confederate states redeemed, quote unquote, themselves at the expense of black rights, especially the right to vote. He writes, the gains of Reconstruction were systemically erased, and the country witnessed the rise of white supremacy ideology. Whites in power found ways to skirt the law, waging a campaign of terror, including the practice of lynching. The North would lend its support in the interest of economic development. Slavery just morphed into the practice of sharecropping, inviting people to take a share of the profits for their land while gouging them for basic necessities so that they never got ahead, were always beholden and tied again to the owner of the land. Sharecropping sort of morphed into the whole separate but equal of de facto segregation in the South, what we call Jim Crow, and discriminatory employment, housing, and education practices in the North, many of which continue to this day. So we all know that America was founded on democratic principles. All men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But America was also founded on the principles of a market economy, a particular kind of market economy, an economy that needed surplus labor, slaves, to turn the wheels of commerce. The discovery of the African-American burying ground in Portsmouth reminds us that slavery was not only a Southern institution. Seafaring merchants from New England participated in the slave trade, traveling to the West Indies and Africa with goods in return for human cargo. Slavery was an inaugural part of the way America did business in the world from the very beginning. And if you want to know about this history of the African-American burying ground and other local stories, I'm going to be showing the documentary Shadows Fall North this coming Thursday, the 20th at 6:30, and I'd love to have you join me for that. And so America was founded on this third principle, if you will, that the elite have the power to build their fortunes on the backs of those who serve their interests. Those people became subservient. To rationalize their treatment, they had to become less than fully human by virtue of their status, denying their equality, their inherent worth and dignity. Americans have somehow learned to live with this paradox, this pattern, to which those of us with privilege have, to a certain extent, become adjusted. We say we believe in equality and justice while whole groups of people, primarily black and brown people, continue to be marginalized and mistreated. Audre Lorde is one of my heroes. She was a black woman who wrote from a position of an outsider. In her book, Sister Outsider, she writes, institutionalized rejection of difference is an absolute necessity in a profit economy that needs outsiders as surplus people. As members of such an economy, we have all been programmed to respond to the human differences between us with fear and loathing, and to handle that difference in one of three ways. To ignore it, if that's not possible, copy it if we think it's dominant, or destroy it. Destroy it if we think it's subordinate. but we have no patterns for relating across our human differences as equals. We have no patterns for relating across our human differences as equals. That pattern of inequity has been with us since the founding of our country. As a result, those differences have been misnamed and misused in the service of separation and confusion. As a result, in this country, we're still waging a campaign of terror against black lives and black bodies. It's no accident that What's Love Got to Do with It is the title of a song about an abusive relationship. It seems important to me to say out loud that black folks have been in an abusive relationship with this country for 400 years. Civil rights attorney Bryan Stevenson writes, "I actually think the great evil of American slavery wasn't involuntary servitude and forced labor. The true evil of American slavery was the narrative we created to justify it, the psychology behind it." He goes on to say, "They made up this ideology of white supremacy that could be reconciled with our Constitution." Sorry, I was trying to figure out what my typo was there. "They made up an ideology of white supremacy that could be reconciled with our Constitution, that cannot be reconciled with a commitment to fair and just treatment of all people. They made it up so they could feel comfortable while enslaving other people. Slavery didn't end in 1865, it just evolved. The North won the Civil War, but the South won the narrative war." The story that this country has told itself at some level throughout the entire course of our history as a country is this narrative that somehow black people are inferior to white people. It's still with us each and every day. Just a few months ago, Vox reported in Mobile, Alabama, Ron Law walked into the break room at work and found a noose hanging from the ceiling. It's in 2019. It was one of eight nooses that black employees reported discovering at the Austal USA shipyard, according to court filings. They were part of a chilling pattern. The workers' alleged racist graffiti regularly appeared in the men's restrooms. The workers described images of hanging men, threats against specific employees, and Ku Klux Klan references scribbled inside stalls and on mirrors and walls. It just doesn't seem to me that love has been enough to root out the fear and hatred of racial difference between black and white folks in this country. And I'm afraid that where we get stuck sometimes, we get stuck in the whole love thing, love your neighbor as yourself, the whole Christian notion of love. When, if we really revisit the civil rights era, we begin to understand that there was something else going on, something else at work, something feeding that force of love, a fierce need for self-determination. In a recent interview with Kristen Tippett, the civil rights legend Ruby Sales talks about being steeped in black folk religion growing up. She makes it clear that black folk religion is not the institutionalized church. It was the folk religion that grew out of secret gatherings and backward clearings where slaves gathered to lift themselves and each other up. And it was in the songs. Songs about love. I love everybody. I love everybody. I love everybody in my heart. She says, hate was not a word in their vocabulary. Why? She says, and I quote, "I cannot control the world, but I can control myself, and you will not coerce me into hating." Self-determination. This kind of love is empowering. the kind of moral grounding, a love for humanity that grew out of the need to love themselves. We're going to talk more about polarization next week, but can you imagine how different our discourse would be if it were grounded in this kind of love? I love everybody. I love everybody. I'd like to believe that it might have the power to help us change some of those patterns that we've held for so long about relating across difference. Not just racial difference, regional difference, economic difference. Black folk religion combined the ideals of American democracy with a sense of justice that included all people. Ruby Sales says, "Black folk religion was the ground we stood on to stand against the winds of Southern apartheid." Can you imagine a love so strong that it would help you live through what black folks lived through in the South in particular? I think we could all use a little of that grounding right now, especially. And I believe we're called to actively pursue it. I love everybody in my heart. It's a kind of love that calls us to be wise as serpents, rooting out patterns of injustice, and as gentle as doves. As it says in Matthew, in the book of Matthew, loving one another into the fullness of our being. In the words of Martin Luther King, who said, "We have to be tough-minded and tender-hearted." You can bet your bottom dollar that Ruby Sales and other folks living, black Americans living, especially in the South during the time of Jim Crow, knew what they were up against. And still, they knew that they had to love. They had to love themselves. They had to live with dignity. They had to rise above. They had to have a sense of self-determination. And I think there's a lot of hopelessness in our culture right now. And we need to kind of find that sense of we can't let them tell us to hate. We can't let them tell us how to live out our values in the world. We have to be willing to change the narrative, which means other things, talking to each other and our children, being honest about how things really are, what the patterns really are. Teaching our kids, helping each other to be detectives, to see and to root out all the ways that those systems of oppression morph over time. I mean, the whole voting rights issue, it's like we thought we took care of that in 1965. And now we're seeing that since 2012, when there were more black voters than white voters in this country, the Supreme Court actually said, states who used to be supervised by the federal government on how you ran your elections can now do whatever you want. You can impose tests. You can't impose a literacy test, but you can require voter IDs, for example, and other ways that prevent people of color from getting their votes counted. These institutions continue to shift. The prison industrial complex has been dubbed the new Jim Crow. And we have all these terrible, horrific stories of black men dying at the other end of a police gun. That's why, my friends, black lives matter. And black lives have always mattered because of this history and these insidious patterns that continue to plague our country and our culture. 400 years of American history tell the story. And I encourage you to learn more, because the more that you learn, the harder it gets not to be maladjusted to what's going on today. This book, Henry Louis Gates' book, is loaded with illustrations of the media propaganda that was going on during this period of redemption in the South after Reconstruction. Pictures of white men in power with their heels on the necks of black people. Animistic pictures of black people. They look like monkeys and elephants and all kinds of other less than fully human things. If anybody wants to take a look, it's really actually quite horrifying, but I think it's important that we really see the vehemence that's there and what people will do to keep the narrative going. It's simply incredible. Love will only have something to do with justice when we can ground ourselves in our history and call it out for what it is. And what it is white supremacy. It is the dominant narrative, but it is white supremacy, especially in this context. It's been that way since the beginning, and it's with us still. But we do have a power. We have the power of love. We have the power of self-determination. We have the power to say, I love, I love, I love everybody in my heart, and you are not going to make me hate anybody. We can't control the haters, but we can control ourselves. We can't let them make us hate. We can't let them wear us down. We have to stay maladjusted. In that light, I invite you to explore what's being called the eighth principle. How many of you are familiar with the eighth principle of Unitarian Universalism? You know, our principles aren't etched in stone. They have evolved over time. And there's a new one on the horizon. Let me share the language with you. It's being discussed. It'll probably be part of both regional and our National General Assembly, but this is the language as it stands right now. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying towards spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in ourselves and in our institutions. Can we make this a formal part of what we value in common? I really hope that we can, because I really think it speaks to who we really want to be in the world. May it be so. Blessed be, and amen.